ranked one of America's top research universities, the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee plays a vital role in shaping the future of Milwaukee and Wisconsin. UWM's diversity, academic excellence, and world-class research contribute to the region's economic development and quality of life. Meet the people behind the creativity and discoveries on UWM today. Here's the host, Tom Lujack, Vice Chancellor of University Relations.
Keeping your weight under control is one of those guiding rules we all hear from our doctors. For adults, it can be a challenge. But if you're a child, especially one with special needs, dealing with obesity can be particularly difficult. On this edition of UWM Today, we meet an expert on child obesity. Michelle Pulfis is an associate professor at UWM's College of Nursing, and she currently is leading a $3.6 million federal grant to investigate weight issues. Michelle is also serving as the joint research chair in the nursing of children at both UWM and Children's Hospital of Wisconsin. Michelle, welcome. Great to have you on today's program.
Thank you so much for having me.
You bet. So the whole issue of dealing with weight is one that is an industry. I mean, you know, every year, you know, a new diet comes along and people often, I go to the gym most every day and I hear people around me constantly saying, oh man, another pound here, another pound there. It is tough for adults, but your focus is on children. How much more difficult is it dealing with a child who has weight issues?
Oh, gosh, that's a great question. I think it's really difficult for them because they have so many less areas that they are responsible for. So it initially starts where their family does a lot of the choices for them. And so their environment is more controlled by elsewhere. And then when they go to school, that is also controlled by other people. And then as they get older, whatever habits have been instilled really start to stay with them. And so hopefully they've had good habits, but it gets harder to change those habits, and especially in the environment that we are in. So even as they kind of break away from their family a little bit more, they're now with their friends, and whatever those habits are going to influence them. So environment, community, friends, family all play such a really important role.
How about genetics? I mean, how big of an issue is that for youngsters?
It's huge because obviously that sets the stage for it. And just because you have poor genetics doesn't mean that you're going to inevitably have obesity issues, but it does mean that you're at a much higher risk of it. So it's that old adage of it loads the gun, but the environment pulls the trigger. So it puts you at that little bit more of a risk factor than others.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the grant that that you're helping to lead. Federal government realizes this is an issue. It's a $3.6 million grant. What specifically are you and your colleagues looking at or for?
Well, it's really fascinating. What we're looking at is, as I just mentioned, obviously everyone recognizes obesity is an issue, but what we don't hear and what is so amazing to me is that even though we do hear, like you said, every day people talking about obesity, rarely do we hear that there's a population of children or individuals that have a much higher obesity than others, and that's individuals with developmental disabilities. And it's kind of odd that we don't hear it because as I was learning and working with general obesity, it took a colleague of mine to bring that to my attention. And once she did that, I was able to see, boy, she's correct. We don't pay attention to that. But individuals with certain disabilities can have 2 to 3 times higher prevalence of obesity. So that is initially the problem. And when looking at research, we have to start figuring out why is that? And when we're looking at why that is, it took me down a little rabbit trail. And that rabbit trail was really interesting because I found that we don't even have a good way to define obesity in some of these children, much less measure it, energy in and energy out well. So it's a whole different situation for them. And I think as we put into our grant submission, the NIH, particularly the NICHD, which is really a great institute for individuals with disabilities, recognize that this is an area that needs further research, and they supported us.
So, Michelle, what kind of special needs, what kind of conditions are the more likely ones where you will see children with obesity problems?
Are there
special disabilities that tend to make a young person more prone to being overweight?
There are. There certainly are. And there's many. I couldn't take them all on. But my particular area of interest, especially for this grant, are children with spina bifida. But also Down syndrome, autism, and many, many others are areas I've dabbled in and also have a higher risk.
And so what have you found so far? Any results yet, or are you still early on in the study?
Well, we're early on in our study. In our study, everyone assumes, as I would love to be, that we're going to intervene and try to influence or change the obesity rates. But what I found is that, as mentioned, we don't have a way to define obesity or measure it well in these children. So part of our grant is focusing on how to determine or define obesity in a clinical environment for them. Similar as to when you and I go to our providers, we want that same luxury of someone to objectively tell us if we have a weight issue. And then in addition, we're looking at energy expenditure, which we know is decreased for individuals with this disability. And we want to know how much decreased, because if I don't know how much my energy expended is decreased, I don't know how much to provide them anticipatory guidance to say this is what your child should be eating in a day. And it just sets them up for an uphill battle that they already have more challenges than they need.
You know, getting answers to those questions about energy in, energy out is challenging for adults. How do you do it with kids? What instruments or techniques are you using to measure how much they're moving?
I would say my first rule of thumb is have a really wonderful team and develop a team of researchers that work with me. And so I cannot take credit for that, but I do take credit for choosing people that have been wonderful, that have worked with us on our pilot studies or our smaller studies. And then I'm constantly learning because it's not my area of background, but I'm finding out more and more, too, as I am working with the team. So one of the biggest interesting pieces of tools that we're using is called double-labeled water. And that is a really interesting way to measure energy expenditure, but it also can measure body composition. It's quite expensive, and it's more rare, and it's not something you would typically do, but in research, it works very well. I can talk more about that if you'd like.
Yeah, I'm curious. Yeah. It sounds intriguing.
It's double-labeled water is actually water that has two isotopes added to it. And as a person ingests the water with the isotopes, you can measure the excretion through blood, urine, or saliva over a 1 to 2 week period. And based on that, you can measure daily energy expenditure. And then you also can use that. Total body water is measured with that. And then through that, you calculate out body fat and fat-free mass. So much higher level than I had ever anticipated working with, but to my fortune, the first scientist who ever used double-labeled water in humans is Dr. Dale Schiller, who happens to be at UW-Madison, and he was just nice enough when I contacted him to say, of course, we can work together. So we did a pilot study, and he's on our larger grant, and that's one of our pieces of equipment that I think will give us a lot of good information.
Wow. Here I was thinking, you know, you have a scale.
Oh, we do have those.
or a tape measure. But this is far, far more sophisticated.
That'll provide us a way to assess our validity and check against using the scales and other more clinically feasible tools. And that's our goal, is that we want to come up with something that's feasible to occur in a clinical environment that's cost-effective and time-efficient. Because having worked in a healthcare, you can't have something that's going to be lengthy or expensive. It just won't work.
Yeah. So as you determined what the appropriate body composition is, how much energy is being used, is it your notion right now that you may be able to recommend exercise programs or dietary changes if you do see that some kids are peaking off the chart?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. If we know exactly or a better understanding of how much energy expended in a day they have, we can work with interventions to work on trying to prescribe or guide physical activity that can help them. And then we also at the same time can give them better guidance on how much they should be eating in a day so that balance between energy in and energy out is more closely found. I always talk about the fact that if we know that these children have a lesser energy expenditure, and in one of our pilot studies, it was small, but we found 500 to 800 calories less a day was being expended in that child compared to their counterpart. And if you have a family of two children sitting at the dinner table, you would never assume to give someone that much less food in a day. So obviously, it's a small study and we need to do more work, but we want to be able to provide anticipatory guidance to families because they really respect and they need to hear that from respected healthcare providers.
Yeah, but, and you mentioned families. That has to be a key component here in helping to not only understand how obesity occurs, but how to prevent it. Because, I mean, if I had a child with special needs, I think, frankly, the sentiment that I would have is, of course, you know, they've got other problems in their lives. Let them have a piece of cake. Let them have that second helping. Mm-hmm. You know, I would probably err on the side of saying whatever. I mean, if that makes you happy, given the limitations you have. But it sounds like I may not be doing them a favor if I do that.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a really good point. And I do think we've found that in one of our studies we did were interviews with families. It was interesting because my basic premise, which was proven and always has been proven, is that parents want to do what's best for their children. Sometimes they're not always aware of what they are doing and the benefits or the potential negative influences that they could be having. So part of it is education. But at the same time, you know, I think everyone deserves to have variety in their life. And it's not negative to say that they should be punished or taken away, but moderation. Part of this is just leveling the playing field. When you go to the provider's office, you want someone to be able to give you objective information, and then you can go home and make decisions. So if we give them that information and we give them good guidance, I think they will make the right decisions on limiting those extras. And I also know that parents are really stressed, and it's hard in this world, and there's much more convenience with processed foods and fast foods. So we have to look at it from all angles and try to take care of those parents so they can do a better job of taking care of their kids.
Yeah, I mean, I could imagine parents themselves might have challenges on the weight front because of the stress and the anxiety that comes with dealing with a child who has those special needs.
I think we have that with all our children. But in addition, you're right, that is a specific area. And that was actually shown in one of our studies that they feel they know what they should be doing, and they feel that they are not always able to role model. And the child obviously is always watching any parent. So if they're stressed and they're reaching for a cookie, they know that that's not always the best thing to show their child. So then that puts additional guilt or blame on them, which no one wants to have. And so the idea is that really it's a family affair, trying to make healthy decisions, trying to do things in moderation, and trying to work as a whole unit.
And as you point out, if there are other children in the home who don't have those same disabilities, then you're really creating two diets, or you have two different considerations when it comes to serving portions.
Yes, portions are the big point. It's not that one should ever be really saying you don't have a weight issue, so you should be allowed Twinkies, because that's not the case. But it's really, can we have healthy diets for everyone, or healthy intake overall, and can we do it in moderation when we do have the choices that are not as healthy?
Yeah, fascinating. You're listening to UWM Today right here on WUWM. So good to have you with us this week. I'm Tom Lujack, and joining us in the studio is Michelle Polfus. Michelle is an associate professor at UWM's College of Nursing. She is a specialist in obesity in children and currently engaged in a major federally funded project, National Institute of Health funded project, to get a better understanding, a better handle on how to deal with weight issues with children, particularly those with disabilities. I mentioned at the beginning of the program, Michelle, that in addition to your work at UWM, teaching and doing research, you also have this wonderful title, serving as a joint research chair of nursing in children at both UWM and at Children's Hospital. That just came along a couple of years ago. It's something new, and it is something very exciting, I think, to have the two institutions working closely together. Tell us about that role.
Thank you. It's quite an honor. The position has been here for a longer period, and the experts prior to me being in this role have been amazing. So to follow them, it's, as I said, an honor to have this position. This is my second year of working in the position, and it just it's an opportunity that really allows myself and allows UWM College of Nursing and the Children's Hospital to work together so we can translate research, we can bring attention to different issues that nurses are working in, and we can also help students and current nurses get exposed to research that maybe they haven't been in the past.
Well, let's talk about some of that research. What other work beyond this obesity study is taking place between the two institutions?
Yeah, there is fascinating work. Nurses do so much I mean, maybe everyone already knows that, but they really are dabbling in different areas of research that we never would have thought of. We have a study going on where we're looking at the non-caloric artificial sweetener effect in type 1 diabetics, and does that have a negative effect on body composition? We are putting a grant submission in that is looking at provider communication with parents during chronic conditions of the child. We have other researchers that are working on newborn infant feeding and attachment, discharge planning, and discharge education to the families to help the child not have to come back to the hospital sooner. There's just a myriad of things that we could go on and on about.
So you mentioned the students. They are certainly the next generation of caregivers and researchers. Are there opportunities for nursing students to also be exposed to this sort of research before they even get out of school?
Yes, I think we're trying to do that more and more, and it's really become a mainstay. With the College of Nursing at UWM being an R1 institution, it exposes them much earlier because they see the faculty who are teaching them and doing their own research, and so that, number one, gives them the opportunity to visualize that nurses do this type of research. Then, in addition, they have the proximity to go up and talk to the faculty member who's doing it or to ask to be involved with it. So that's one piece. And then in the hospital setting, when they're doing clinicals, beyond UWM, nurses all over are doing amazing research, and we have a nursing research department at Children's Hospital, and so they get to be exposed that way also. So I think it just shows them that it's not a silo and that it's really happening more and more, and they'll start to see that teams work together, providers work together, and it's not just nurses doing research, but it's interdisciplinary teams that really can move and translate science to the bedside.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about that interdisciplinary research because it's not just a question of nurses talking to other nurses, but they're interacting with the other providers, including physicians, including other scientists, correct?
You bet. Yes. So I know my research easiest, and I can say that if you think about it from a kinesiology background, I have experts that are in that world. You have the experts that are looking at medical backgrounds that can tell us different pieces. You have the nurses who can look at it from their perspective. So putting it all together, it's amazing how you can start to be synergizing how it can work together. So physical therapists, dietitians, and nurses, physicians, they all do a lot of research that is done not independently.
I got to ask, you're a professor, and so you spend time in the academic world. You have this major research project going. You also have your duties out at Children's Hospital. Mm-hmm. For the average nurse, though, the woman or the fella on the floor who are providing that care to the patients, do they ever get involved in these research projects, or do you have two separate worlds, you know, the people who are on the front line, in the trench, so to speak, and others who are in the laboratory?
That is a super great point. No, we depend on them because oftentimes, if you think about it, the person who is at the bedside has the question and says, why are we doing it this way? Or I've started to notice, why don't we think about this? And using their expertise, that can spur some of the best research questions. And then when we're actually implementing research in the hospital setting, they oftentimes are a very large role in it. One of the studies that we did recently as our Pediatric Nursing Consortium, which is a combination of Marquette University, UW-Milwaukee and Children's Hospital. As representatives, nurses from each of those institutions work on projects together, and we looked at discharge education and how it was being implemented, and is there a better way to guide and engage parents in that? So we created an app, and we did a trial on two different units of the hospital, and when those units were engaged, we had hundreds of nurses that actually went through the training and implemented it with us. And now the biggest piece is that we get to go back to them and say, because of your hard work, these are what we're starting to find.
And it must be a great outlet for those nurses who are on the front line to know that their voices are being heard. It's not just, you know, their job isn't just to keep doing the same thing, but to find new ways of doing those things better, right?
Yeah, I hope they know that because they are so instrumental. They are definitely, if not, we ask for focus groups. We ask them to come to us if they have ideas or if they're starting to have questions. Sometimes their work might involve evidence-based practice projects, which is not technically research, but it's another way of looking at the evidence and seeing what's out there that's being done elsewhere and implementing it at your own facility. And that we have a very large EBP group at Children's Hospital that does that, and then in addition to the research that we're doing and quality improvement projects.
You talk about the other providers that work together alongside the nurses. Let's talk a little bit about the patients themselves. Children, as you mentioned earlier, as we were talking about your work around obesity, sometimes what they do, how they act is influenced tremendously by the parents, especially young children who don't, you know, really have as much of a say in what they're going to do or not be doing. Are there opportunities for the patients, even the younger ones, though, to provide feedback that gets factored into your research?
Absolutely. Whether they know it or not, they are really valuable for my research and others' research. So part of it is you can see and you can talk to the parents and you can talk to the children, and they will be giving you their feedback. And kids are amazing because they're honest. They'll just tell it like it is. So when they are giving you feedback, you really want to take a listen to that, and you want to integrate it into either what the problem is or what the potential solutions could be.
So, for example, you're studying child obesity. You know, young fella or young gal is overweight, and you know they have other issues. They're overweight. Do they talk? Are they comfortable talking about their weight and comfortable talking to you about how or if they can change things?
Previously, as a clinician, I was working in a childhood obesity program, and you know, it's silly to say that we don't know that they or that they're not aware that they have an abnormal weight. If you're truly overweight or obese, people know. And kids are unfortunately among their peers, and peers are not always very friendly. And so they oftentimes will take more on themselves. And so body image is a really important piece. And you want to be careful when you talk about weight issues because you don't want to start to put a number in their head. It's really about being healthy. So if you can reframe it, it's always the best way to do it. But I don't think that kids are immune to understanding that they have a different body than others.
Yeah, so, and so really important that you not only recognize that they have feelings, but that you find a way to get those feelings, those thoughts, their opinions on the table.
You bet. And yeah, you want a safe environment. And it's just not it's not easy being a child any day. And they have a lot of different stressors of their own that we don't always think about as adults. So we have to be really cautious with that. And taking that back to children with disabilities, you know, when they have that overweight or obesity issue, not only does it affect their body image, but it also affects their ability to be independent or as they're growing to self-manage their own health. And that's what we want everyone to do, is to be growing healthy and to do those things.
What advice would you give a parent who's listening to this program who does have a child who's overweight? What should they be doing to help that child without becoming overbearing or putting even more pressure on the kid who has some self-image issues?
Yeah. Well, I think, first of all, talking to their provider, having an objective discussion that says, you know, maybe they assume that their child has a weight issue, but you really want to see that on paper and you want to see what we're looking at. And so having a discussion with a provider in a healthcare environment would be a good start. And then they often will have resources for them. But I think starting with looking at a parent themselves, what are we doing? Are we being active? Are we eating as good as we could be as a family? Am I putting good choices in that pantry for the child to grab? So looking at those pieces, and it's not
all. So what kind of role model are you?
Exactly. You said it. So role modeling would be super important. And then if they need more additional help than that, there are resources out there. But you really want to get someone that's trained in pediatrics that can do a good job of being cautiously how they approach the issue.
Such a complex issue, isn't it? I mean, you know, again, at the beginning of the program, I talked about how we as adults often are struggling. You know, we look at the scale and say, man, I thought I worked out hard yesterday, and where did that come from? You know, when you're dealing with children and children who have these complications, you know, got to be just an awfully confounding issue to deal with.
Yeah, I think if you just look at the grocery store and you just look at it from a child's level, you'll see what they're up against. Obviously, marketing is such a industry in itself. And if you would walk at the toddler or a school-age child's level, just walk down the cereal aisle, you'll never see the healthy cereals at that level. You're going to see all the character cereals and all the high-sugar cereals. And it's really hard to work against such a large marketing industry. And I know even talking to families, they'll say, well, it said it was made with whole grain, so it must be good. And I said, yes, but it also has Lucky Charms and has marshmallows in it, so we know it's probably not as good. So it's unfair to the common person because you have to have a degree and have to almost understand how to work against marketing.
You have to be a mini nutritionist yourself at home, right?
True.
At what age should you start talking to your child about weight? You often hear that. For example, you see some kids who are a little larger, and you know, I've in my family we've said, well, that's just baby fat.
Yeah.
Don't worry about it. It's just baby fat. There is such a thing. I mean, you want kids to be plump and healthy, but at what's the cross point where you say, you know, it's not just baby fat? Yeah.
I think the easy answer is we would never really want to highlight weight. But as when you think about when you take your child to the provider's office, they oftentimes will say, in comparison with your peers, you're at the 50th percentile for height, you're at the 50th percentile for weight, and the body mass index says that you're in a really healthy weight for your age. That's probably as much as we talk about weight. If there was an abnormal level, it's probably a good time to say, so tell me about what you're eating, tell me about what you eat when you're out with your friends or at school. So traditionally, a BMI becomes more valid at age 2 and above, but as children are getting older, that BMI chart is really helpful for the traditional child without disabilities because it gives you an idea of objectively looking at trajectory of weight. And if you start to see them skipping deviations much higher, faster, that's probably a time to say we need to talk about what they're eating or how much activity they're getting.
But as you point out, that works really well if you're talking about a child without a disability. But your work right now is to hone in on that population that does have disabilities where you don't have that mean, you don't have that norm to go ahead and compare a child to.
It's disappointing because they will still use a BMI chart even though we know a BMI chart for that child is not going to be accurate. So it's going through the steps, but really not helping them with accurate information. If you think about a BMI, it's based on height and weight. And if a child that has a disability can't have an accurate height measured, garbage in, garbage out, you're not going to get good data. So it's just setting them up for inaccurate information. And it really isn't fair to the family because that's what our job is to do as providers, is to give them accurate information.
So it's not just, you know, the parents' responsibility to make sure they're informed, but the healthcare providers, the doctors, the nurses themselves mm-hmm. have to know that there may be differences here and you have to step out of the comfort zone and look for different ways of getting answers to whether or not the child is or isn't on track.
Exactly. And so hopefully with our study and with other people working in this area, we'll get to have a more accurate way to provide information to those families too.
Well, fascinating conversation, Michelle. Thank you so much. Thank you for the work that you're doing with your research, both at UWM and at Children's Hospital. And we wish you the very best. As you get those results in, we'll have you back on sometime to talk about what you learned.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
You bet. Michelle Polfus, associate professor at UWM's College of Nursing, also a person who serves as the joint research chair in the nursing of children at both UWM and Children's Hospital of Wisconsin. We're so glad she was our guest on this edition of UWM Today. That's all for this week's program. Remember, you can listen to any of our programs over the last few years. Just go to the WUWM.com website, look for the UWM Today program under the program listing, and we've got all the shows archived there for you to go back and give another listen to. Take care, everybody. We'll see you next week at the same time. I'm Tom Lujack.
You've been listening to UWM Today with host Tom Lujack, the weekly program where you get to meet the people behind one of America's top research universities, University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Playing a vital role in shaping the future of Milwaukee and Wisconsin, UWM's diversity, academic excellence, and world-class research contribute to the region's economic development and quality of life. Learn more at uwm.edu.